to a special edition of the GDB Podcast, the industry's first and longest-running podcast, now in our 16th year. I'm Roger Gross, the publisher of GGB. In this special edition, we sit down with Arnold Snyder, a professional gambler and author of Radical Blackjack, a new book describing his experiences in playing blackjack and making advantage plays in various casinos. This week's program is brought to you by Konami Gaming. Later in the show, we'll talk to you about two Konami slot series ranked top-grossing premium lease games by Eilers and Krychek. Arnold Snyder is a legend in the gambling industry, a professional gambler, and one of seven original members of the Blackjack Hall of Fame. Snyder launched the magazine Blackjack Forum, which was the Bible for blackjack players for over 20 years. He recently published his ninth book on gambling called Radical Blackjack, in which he outlines his strategies, locations, and individuals that were previously not mentioned in any of his other books. He's speaking at the World Game Protection Conference, February 15th, at the Tropicana in Las Vegas. He spoke with me at the offices of his publisher, Huntington Press, in October. Welcome to the Global Gaming Business Podcast. Our guest today is Arnold Snyder. Arnold, thanks for joining us. You know, I read your new book, Radical Blackjack, and it's just as good as your other books. I think it's going to be a classic for the modern blackjack player.
Well, I hope so.
When you were young, you know, how did you get interested in gambling? What were you interested in as a kid, basically?
Let me see. You know, I was a weird kid. Yeah. I was a typical nerd.
Yeah.
Was really into reading. Mm-hmm. I had very thick glasses, you know,
right,
in the first grade. And this is when, you know, this is before they had plastic type lenses.
Sure.
You know, I mean, they really were like, you know, the bottoms of pop bottles. And you know, so I was really into reading. I was good at math, but I didn't like math.
Right.
I liked reading. But at a very young age, I wanted to be a writer,
okay,
which is, you know, probably a crazy thing
sure.
for a kid to want to do. But I just loved reading stories, you
sure.
know. And I remember when I was 8 years old, which would have been 1956.
Okay.
You know, I begged my parents that there was in the Sears Roebuck catalog. There was a printing press. It was a Superior Cub printing press, and it said, "Oh, now you can print your own, you know, whatever, you know." And I thought, "Well, I want to be a writer." I was ready to start my own publishing company. Eight years old.
Huh?
And it was a crazy thing. It had these little wire racks that you inserted rubber type into with
right.
tweezers, and you could. But it had all the, you know, capitals and small letters
yeah.
and all the punctuation. It took forever,
oh,
and
right.
it was, you know, and of course because they're printing, all the letters are backwards.
Right.
So you get the thing set up, and then you go to print it, and you find out your B's and your D's are all confused, you know, because you just can't separate them in your mind
right.
that way. But I started, I started printing stories I wrote
okay. mm-hmm.
that I would inevitably throw away after. I mean, I'd print like, you know, one copy of them. And
right.
a long one would be like 2.5 to 3 pages,
right.
you know, and they were, you know, they were not big pages.
Right.
And but they were like short stories, and I was printing them, but then I would throw them away before anybody ever read them.
Really?
A lot of them were, you know, to me too personal and
sure.
embarrassing.
Right.
You know, but I mean, I was just doing this from a very young age.
Sure.
I wanted to be was a writer.
Right.
But as far as gambling, you know, I had never been in a casino.
Right.
I'd never. You know, I mean, gambling, you know, when we were kids, we used to play poker, probably with all the
right.
wrong rules, and, you know, half
or,
the cards
or
were wild.
Baseball cards, right?
Right. Yeah, right. You know. You know, and, but, you know, just playing with poker chips,
right.
you know. But, I didn't know anything about gambling.
Sure.
Didn't care anything about it. When I was, so I didn't get any interest whatsoever in it until, it was in the mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was sick at home for a few days, and somebody brought me some books, said, well, I stopped by Moe's. This was in Berkeley, California.
Okay.
And And they gave me like half a dozen used books they picked up. Mm-hmm. Said, well, these looked interesting if you, you just, you're laying around the house.
Right.
I really appreciate it, but one of them was Beat the Dealer by Ed Thorpe.
Okay.
And it was the 1966 version. Mm-hmm.
So a little bit updated then.
Yeah, and I read that book from cover to cover. I was fascinated. I was like, oh, come on, can you really do this? Come on. Yeah, yeah. It's not, like, I'd never heard of anything like a professional gambler. Mm-hmm. I had no idea how to play blackjack.
Right.
You know, what? That wasn't a, you know, I think we played that when I was a kid too, but I'm sure we played with all the wrong rules.
Sure,
you
right.
know. But I, you know, I just, I had friends that would, you know, I was living in the Bay Area, and I had friends that would drive up to Reno or Lake Tahoe, you know, semi-frequently.
Right.
Just to go to the casinos. It was, you know, it was very inexpensive kind of vacation.
So what jump started your interest in gambling? I mean, where you were in the age that the Ed Thorpe book Beat the Dealer came out. So how did that work?
Yeah, well, I wish I would have known anything about his book back when it came out in 1962, at which time I would have been 14 years old. I didn't know anything about it until the mid-70s.
Okay.
And it was the 1966 version of his book. You know, I was ill. Somebody gave me the book to read and said, oh, you might find this interesting. And I was just absolutely fascinated. I was working at the post office at the time. I was divorced from my wife. I had a son that was living with me. My daughter was living with her. And basically, she couldn't work. And so I was basically paying for two small households on a mailman's salary.
Right.
So I didn't really have any money, but I just thought, this sounds incredible. Could I actually make a living by playing cards? I mean, I just found it, you know, but he sounded serious.
Sure.
Like,
right,
you know,
right.
like this is real, you know. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, I'm going to drive up there, you know, and I literally, you know, just got in my car and drove up to Reno and stayed there for a weekend, you know, just got a cheap hotel room and walked around looking at the blackjack games and sitting down and playing for, you know, $1 chip. They all had dollar tables then. And basically I wanted to see if, are these games still the same games he talks about? And they were.
Yeah.
I was like, dude, the same rules, the same, you know. And by this point, I had actually picked up a couple of other books. You know, one of them was Lawrence Revere's Playing Blackjack as a Business, which his system was so much easier. And this is because, well, Thorpe had two systems. One was his 10 count, which was incredibly difficult. The other one was, he just called it the point count system. And that was essentially the high-low count.
Right, right.
But he had a extremely difficult method of adjusting for the true count, where you had to, you had to count the exact number. You had to count backwards the number of cards that were coming out of the shoe or the deck. He was mostly thinking in terms of single deck games for card counting. But, you know, he basically said, oh, yeah, you can do this with four decks, too. You just, you know, you start your count at, you know, 208 and count backwards to see, okay, this is the exact number of cards. And, oh, you had to memorize these charts that would have numbers in them, like, you know, 6.3 and 8.2.
Yeah.
And you'd have to take the, you'd keep the point count system, and you'd have to take that number and divide it by the actual number of cards that were played, or was it the other way around?
but
you know, it just gave you these weird ratios, and then you'd compare that to the number in the chart. It was so complicated, but it was easier than the 10-count system, which was also basically counting two groups of cards backwards and then figuring out a ratio between. Well, Revere basically said, you know, divide by the number of decks in play.
Right.
That was it. That basically, you know, that's how pretty much every card counting system since has been, you know, done, because it's the easy way to do it. The thing is, I wasn't getting anywhere.
Right.
I mean, I was playing with dollar chips, and I would, you know, spreading from one to four or one to five, you know.
That was a big bet for you.
but, I was just determined. It's like, was way more fun than delivering mail.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, that was an actual job.
Sure, right,
you know?
Right.
So I just thought, you know, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to do this.
Mm-hmm.
I took a trip to Las Vegas and I found the Gambler's Bookshop and went in and talked to them, and they made recommendations. You know, I met Paul Keene and, mm-hmm. and John Luckman.
Okay.
You know, Edna, they're just the nicest people, and
they
were real generous with knowledge, mm-hmm. and you know, they gave me a couple of papers. One was a technical paper written by Julian Braun,
right.
probably for some gambling conference or mm-hmm. something like that. Development and analysis of something, systems for the casino game of mm-hmm. blackjack or something like that. And another one by Peter Griffin.
Right.
And what I found was that Braun had run simulations of various systems in various games.
Right.
And he showed like what the player's win rate would be using different betting spreads. And one of the things that really stuck out to me was he had the four deck game, and he did it with 75% penetration, which would be three decks dealt.
Mm-hmm.
And then he did one with 80% penetration, which would just be not that many more cards.
Right, yeah.
And the win rate really jumped
mm-hmm.
from 75 to 80% penetration. And I thought, wow, that's crazy. Because I had started, what I wanted to do was I wanted to figure out how much money can I make. I'm
right.
spreading my bets from $1 to $5.
Right.
What can I make on this game, you know? And, you know, because there was nothing that gave any information
sure,
like that.
Right,
no
yeah.
books just
mm-hmm.
talked about that. They didn't talk about the win rate,
right.
you know, and how your betting spread would affect it
mm-hmm.
and how the penetration, and you know. So I got this formula. I basically kind of jerry-rigged a formula from between Peter Griffin's his mathematical analysis and then Braun's computer analysis,
mm-hmm.
so that I had a formula where at 75% penetration, I could figure out what the win rate would be at the different betting spreads
mm-hmm.
that he showed,
right.
and you know, and I thought, well, this is great. Now I can figure out if they do so. But as soon as I went to 80% penetration, my formula didn't work anymore.
Yeah.
Because I would look at what his result was, and I'm going, no, this, you know, what is it? And so I figured what I had to tweak in the formula.
Mm-hmm.
I said, what if I do this so that I would still get the same results for 75,
right.
but it would show how much 80% was worth. And I did that. And there were a couple of other things. I had, you know, a few things Braun had
right.
published with different, you know, penetration levels. And I was able to match all those. So I said, well, this is great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now I can figure out. And I started to figure out, like, what are these games worth? Well, I was looking at the Reno games and I was like, geez, 73 cents an hour.
Right.
You know, this doesn't pay as well as the post office, you know.
Right. Oh, at a dollar.
And so I was like, okay, so how much money do I need to play this game? And, you know, so what happened was I just was very discouraged about playing it
sure.
because I realized, you know, if you're going to go to a casino, you want to go in with about $10,000. You want to be able to make $100 bets,
right?
You know, and you'd really like to make bets of a few hundred each,
mm-hmm.
and you know, spread your bets up and down. And,
right.
and I, you know, it was beyond any. Yeah, I was literally driving up there with $100 or $200
right,
to play with, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it's like. You know, and sometimes I'd win, you know, $50 or $75, and sometimes I'd lose $50 or $70. Sometimes I'd lose it all,
yeah.
You know, very rarely would I double it, you
yeah.
know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I just realized, okay, I'm wasting my time.
Yeah.
This is not the way to do this. And I don't know where I got the idea. I just thought, you know what, I'm going to print up this formula
mm-hmm.
into a book, and I'll self-publish it. It was just one step beyond my little Cub Superior printing press, because what I did was I would write it up
mm-hmm.
and give my written stuff to a girlfriend who was a typist,
mm-hmm.
and she had this is pre-computers,
right?
This
sure,
is
right.
in late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
She had a Xerox word processor. Mm. They were the first word processor. Right. It took up half a room. Right. I mean, it was a huge thing. It's like the size of a Volkswagen. Right. And I mean, and really all it did was, you know, it made bold by sort of double hitting the letter.
Right, right, right.
You know, it would, it would be able to do something, right, but it could justify text. Mm-hmm. So I wanted it text justified for this page size. And so she set it all up and, you know, typed it out and I took the pages. I, you know, literally went to copy mat, and I'm using their paper cutter to get the pages the right size, and I tape bound the edge. You know, they weren't perfect bound, but they had a thing where they glue the edges.
Sure.
You know, one edge to make it into a booklet, which, you know, after a while, if you open it three or four times and starts cracking up. But I mean, that was the, you know, I sent a copy of that to. At this point now, this is probably a few years since I had been, you know, interested in this and, you know, going back and forth to Reno and Tahoe. And I, you know, I sent copies out. I was getting everybody's newsletter.
Right.
I mean, I found out from Gambler's Book Club who all was publishing newsletters because they had them all on their rack.
Sure.
You know, Ken Houston had one. Lance Humble had one. Stanford Wong had one. There were three or four others. Walter Tominski had a Rouge et Noir News, came out of New York. Stanley Slutikoff was doing Gambling Times out of Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And anyway, what I did was I printed up like 100 copies of the book. I didn't tape bind them all at once because I think the tape bind was like 80 cents. And it's like, well, geez, you know, I can't afford to do that with 100 books. It cost me $80. I mean, this is how shoestring it was.
Exactly, right.
And I would, I basically, you know, sent a copy of the book to each of the newsletters. Mm-hmm. I said, this is a new book I wrote.
Yeah.
And, people can order it from me, and I went and I got out one of those mailboxes or us addresses, and I said, you know, they can order from this address. It's $100 a copy.
Yeah.
And amazingly, every single person I sent it to put up this glowing review.
Yeah.
Like, you know, gee, we've never seen anything like this before. This, geez, blackjack players ought to go crazy for this thing. They can figure out how much money they can make and what their win rate is and. You know, which is what it was for.
Sure, exactly.
And Walter Tominski called me from New York, and he said, you know, I got your book. This is great. I'd like to sell it through Rouge et Noir News to my customers. What kind of a discount can you give me if I buy them in quantity? And I said, well, 50%. And he said, okay. And like a few days later, I got a check for $1,000 for 20 copies of this book. I ran over the copy man and said, okay, tape bind these things, you know? And I got, you know, and all the other, you know, Ken Houston and Stanford Wong, all of them just put glowing reviews and said, well, this is really good. I just started getting orders, and the man was like, geez, I'm making thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
Selling a mathematical formula. Yeah,
so you joined your love of writing with your knowledge of gambling, right?
Yeah, right. It's like it was just, it just happened.
Yeah, sure.
You know, it's like I had no interest in gambling.
Yeah.
Until I thought, oh, you can beat it?
Yeah.
You mean you can make money doing this?
Right, yeah.
You know, so I was just, to me it was like, as soon as I got that check for $1,000, and then, I mean, I was getting checks in the mail, just literally daily from these newsletters posting things. There was no internet. You know, at this time, there was no internet. There was no way, you know, I mean, self-published authors, I don't know how they ever made a penny,
you know?
It's like, I just had a product that, like, the blackjack world was ready for.
Yeah, right.
And it was like, that came out, like, in the fall of 1980, and I came out with the first issue of Blackjack Forum, magazine. I think it was about 16 pages or something, the first one. And it was just stapled, you know.
Right.
I had the same typist who was word processing the first issues of that. And I just started, you know, writing articles mm-hmm. about blackjack right. and, you know, just little discoveries I'd made mm-hmm. and games I found and right. weird rule variations. And just, I just had a knack for, say, figuring out the math of right. it.
So you'd point out the best places to play it, where the rules were most favorable?
And well, yeah, and at first it was just like little articles.
Right, yeah.
I didn't have, like, I'm in the second issue, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I got an interview with Julian Braun. Okay. And, you know, Braun, now right. he had not had a book published yet.
Yeah.
But he did the computer work for, mm-hmm. Lance Humble mm-hmm. and Lawrence Revere and Ed Thorpe. I mean, right. all of the, I mean, Stanford Wong did his own computer work.
Right.
Julian Braun did everybody else's yeah. in the early, mm-hmm. in the early right. years. And so he was like the respected name in computer simulations. Mm-hmm. Well, he called me one day and said, I'm going to be in San Francisco for some kind of a computer conference next week. You know, you're going to be around. Why don't we, you know, have dinner? I'll take you to dinner. And I was like, yeah, sure. Yeah. You know, I was like, and so I got an interview with Julian Braun. I yeah. recorded an interview at the dinner, you know, asking him questions yeah. of different things. And I was like, this is crazy. This is the top guy. I already sure, got right, an interview right, in, yeah. in the second issue of this little, you know, self-published, yeah. you know, newsletter. Mm-hmm. I just got so much material from so many people.
Right.
It's like the Blackjack Forum grew. I mean, finally it got up in more than 100 pages.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, we were putting casino conditions for games all over the world. Right. I just had people sending it to me, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
There were like a few players that I paid for information. You know, I needed a guy to do Las Vegas mm-hmm. for me, and I needed someone to do Reno, you know, Northern Nevada. I needed someone to do Atlantic City. There really wasn't any other gambling
right.
other
yeah,
than,
sure,
you know.
It. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
like within a few years, they started the Indian casinos,
right. yeah.
which was great. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, gee, now there's casinos opening in right. all these other states. It was like the industry was growing.
Sure.
And I just got in at the right time.
Right. So you got great reactions from these other experts and I guess from their customers as well. What did you hear from casino executives? Were you on the lookout for them or what?
Well, first of all, I was not playing at all.
Okay.
I mean, you know, if I would keep going to Reno or right. going to Las Vegas, to me, it was like I was just checking out the games.
Right.
Okay. I was looking for mm-hmm. weird rule changes right. or exceptionally good deck penetration, things I could report on.
Sure.
You know, the Blackjack Forum came out every 3 months, mm-hmm. so I had a while to work sure. on the next one. But it really was, it was a one-man show.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. I had literally nobody working yeah. for me. My wife did some editing mm-hmm. and, you know, but mostly it was like, it was a one-man show.
Yeah, so you just wrote everything pretty
much. I wrote it, I laid it out, it. Yeah. I, you know, I typed it up. Mm-hmm. You know, I had a typist that would put it into, yeah. into you know, into order to look right. like a book. And, you know, but I basically was just doing everything.
Sure.
And so I didn't really have, my overhead expenses were like nothing.
Yeah.
I really took advantage of, you know, I went and found an accountant, and he steered me in a lot of good directions. Mm-hmm. But, you know, basically he said, you know, look, you got to start writing off.
Right, sure.
Because I had all this money coming yeah. in, and he's going, what are you spending? And I was showing him. He said, that's your whole printing bill? How did you sell these thousands of dollars of stuff, and your whole printing bill for the month was $230?
Right,
you know, and
yeah.
So I said, well, I'm selling this one book for $100, and it's, you know, and it's not a very long book or yeah. a big book, and it's just photocopied. He's like amazed. He's going, man, you got something going here. He said, but look, you got to start writing off expenses.
Sure, right, yeah.
And I said, well, what can I write off? He said, well, do you ever go to Reno or Vegas? Yeah, all of it. Write it yeah. all off. Keep track.
Yeah.
Every meal, everything mm-hmm. when you're out there. You know, he sure. said. And so I was suddenly, now I was still working at the post office mm-hmm. full time, But it's like, suddenly it's like I had money. I could go where I wanted to go. And I could start gambling a little higher. Sure, I was like, hey, I can spread from $5 to $25 now, you know?
Really big bets.
Because, one, I've always been really tight with money. So I didn't really want to, I wasn't the type that, suddenly I'll just go out and blow it and see if I can make a zillion bucks. I was like, no, really, I'm just checking out the games. Right. The money is in publishing this information.
Yeah.
And, and it wasn't, after, I think it was like 82 when I published Black Belt in Blackjack.
Okay, right.
Which was the first actual book that had sort of like explanations right from the beginning.
Right.
These are the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. These are the rule variations.
Well, I think the thing that was really good about that book is you wrote it in a real simple style, very understandable. You know, again with Thorpe, I mean, he got pretty dense after a while, and certainly Braun. You know, I mean,
yeah, Thorpe is very.
you wrote in a very understandable, easy to understand manner.
Yeah, I as a writer, now, I also spent years trying to write.
Right.
I mean, I actually made my living as a writer, just as a hack writer.
Sure.
When my wife and I this was in the 70s.
Yeah.
That was really all I wanted to do. And, we were getting like Writer's Digest and all these things, right. And
you did query letters and things like that.
Yeah, right. But they there were a lot of recommendations that said, the best way to break in is to do formula writing.
Right, yeah.
And there's all these different formula publications, and the easiest ones to get in. Mm-hmm. There's what there's like the women's mags and the men's mags, and the women's mags being things, if you're a fiction writer, being things like True Story, there was just a whole bunch of them.
Right.
True Story, Inside Story, the real truth story.
Yeah.
there were dozens of them, and. Now we tried sending to True Story. I think True Story paid like 4 cents a word.
Yeah.
And we never got that, but we got into a number of them that paid 2 cents a word. There were some of the knockoff ones. And then the other thing was literally what would be considered today hardcore pornography.
Really?
I don't think it exists in literature form anymore.
Right.
But they used to have these adult bookstores. And it was this was pre-video.
Sure.
Okay? It was before videos were out there.
Little pulp.
Little pulp.
Right.
Yeah. And basically, I mean, I was trying to write humor.
Yeah.
and my wife and I both were. I mean, basically, we were hippies.
Yeah,
we were
sure,
living in San Francisco.
Right.
I was into LSD and,
sure.
And this is like before the post office,
mm-hmm.
right? This
okay.
is early days, 70s, early 70s.
Before you had to get serious, right?
Right. And we started churning out these pulp porn novels. They're all total formula,
right?
But we were, what we found out was this is too much work for the money.
Yeah,
Sure, right, almost like it's easier to work at the post office,
Right.
I mean, we'd get $600 for a book.
Yeah.
Right. $600 for the whole book. And our agent would take 90 because he wanted 15%.
So when did you start getting involved with like the blackjack teams when they really got serious to attacking casinos that had all these decent rules for them?
Yeah. I had correspondence with a lot of them. But I myself was not involved with playing on any of the teams.
Okay.
I sometimes steered players towards a team.
Right.
Somebody would contact me, and I would occasionally give them a reference and say, "Well, you can tell them." This is especially when I knew there was some really serious player, really smart.
Mm-hmm.
Knew the math. Understood. I would sometimes steer them to a team or another team. But I had no real personal involvement or investment or anything with any of the teams.
Okay.
Probably in the 90s, say mid 90s or so, early to mid 90s, when there were a couple of team ventures that I got involved in.
Right.
that, but you know, I was never really that much of a team playing person. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, I was invited very often.
Right.
A lot of players, teams, mm-hmm. you know, and just players would contact right. me and say, you know, look, there's just two of us and we got, you know, 20,000 each. We're combining it to a 40,000 bankroll. You know, would you be interested in playing in our team? You don't have to invest. If you do, then we can cut out. This is the way the math works.
Right.
And, you know, but I got a lot of invitations like this where I didn't really even have to put money up.
Right.
But I just didn't feel comfortable playing on other people's money.
Sure, right.
I
right.
felt like, oh man, how would, you know, they want to play, they want to spread bets from 100 to 600.
Yeah.
Jeez, you know, you could lose a lot. What if I lost thousands of bucks?
Right.
There, you know, I don't know these guys. They might kill me. You know?
Right.
And I was just, you know, just nervous about
right.
the thought of doing it.
So some of the things that happened in the early 80s, you know, there was a lot of, especially in Atlantic City, a lot of regulatory pressure over on the casinos. So there was a little period there where they eliminated, you couldn't bar card counters anymore.
Right.
I was only yeah. lasted for a couple of days. I was there. I was a dealer
right.
in Atlantic City
now,
in those days.
Is this, are you talking about something before Ken Houston won his case?
Before.
Yeah, I sort of remember that occurring. And then
I actually dealt to Ken Houston during one of those.
Oh, really?
Days too.
Really?
Yeah. I remember him doubling down on a 19.
A soft 19.
A hard 19. And
okay. So
I think he was just doing it just to have fun, but I had to call the floor person over.
Right, you know, right, right.
And of course,
right.
the two came out.
Oh, geez, that must have killed him.
I don't know if I flashed the card at him or anything, but you know,
yeah.
It was. But again, that only lasted for a couple of days, and I think that's where the case emanated from. Then he sued them, and you know, then they went. They figured out how to handle it, but so you reported on those kind of things as well in Black
Yeah.
Forum?
I had correspondent, pretty much corresponded with everybody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I had correspondence and a lot of phone talks also with Ken Houston.
Yeah.
And pretty much most of the people that are say in the Blackjack Hall of Fame, mm-hmm. I had correspondence and
sure.
or phone correspondence and or met him when I was in Vegas
right,
or Reno
right.
or whatever. You know, Atlantic City, I didn't go to that much,
right.
but I did because it was a big scene.
Yeah.
But, you know, that would be like maybe once a year or so I'd go out to Atlantic City.
Right.
But, you know, whereas, you know, Reno and Tahoe was a drive.
Right.
You know,
sure.
it's like 3 hours from
right.
the Bay Area.
Right.
Where Vegas was a flight, but
right.
it's like a 1 hour flight.
Yeah, right.
You know,
exactly.
so and it was
right.
a cheap 1 hour
mm-hmm.
flight. You know, it was like I don't know,
yeah.
$79
you couldn't
or something.
Get into Atlantic City. You had to fly to Philly and drive. You know?
Right.
so,
but
yeah.
so you know, I really was not a serious player
mm-hmm.
for decades.
Right.
You know, I was a writer.
Right.
And a connection.
Right.
You know, people used me for connections. You know,
sure.
you know, I put people together that were looking
sure,
for
right,
a team
right.
in the same
mm-hmm.
area. I'd say, well, why don't you check with this guy? You
right,
know,
right.
I don't know him personally,
sure.
but he's been reading
yeah.
the magazine for a couple of years. He seems like a smart guy, and
sure.
I know he's, you know.
Since September, two high-performing Konami slot series have ranked in Iroh's and Krychek's list of top-performing parent games / premium leased. Both All Aboard and Ocean Spin have demonstrated consistently strong results, and both are available now on Dimension 49J, awarded first place for best slot product in this year's GGB Gaming and Technology Award. Learn more by visiting konamigaming.com/premiums.
So let's talk about your new book, Radical Blackjack. This is, as I said, I read it, but in this book you actually name names and places and a lot of details that you hadn't previously talked about because you wanted to, I guess, protect your sources. But you actually get into names here, and I thought it was a really fascinating book. What really surprised me, though, is that you really focused, you know, a lot of it on the advantage play here, where a casino would come up with a promotion and you knew it was beatable. Tell us how that worked out.
Well, you know, the person who really went to town on that was Stanford Wong.
Right.
He was like legendary
right.
for that. He would. What did he call them? They called him some kind of a party, a Pai Yee
mm-hmm.
press party
right,
or something
yeah.
like that, where He would literally send an email or a phone text. It would depend on what period.
Right.
But he would alert everybody. Mm-hmm. This is especially after he got his website going.
Right.
We all got websites going in the 90s.
Sure. Right.
But he would alert people to these, they're going to have a 2-to-1 blackjack promotion at such and such casino. And I mean, he would put that out, and 150 card counters would show up. You couldn't get a seat, I went to a couple of those, mm-hmm. There was one in Las Vegas that I learned about, he and I were both doing some kind of a panel discussion or mm-hmm. something for a conference. And he told me, he said, oh yeah, there's a really good promotion going on right now at the Klondike. I didn't even know what the Klondike was. I don't think anybody did.
Yeah, right.
But what did he call it? I can't remember. It was something like Second Chance or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact name. But what it was, let's see, if you're a Delta certain card, you could save it and use it later. It was a crazy promotion.
Right.
But he had figured it out. And said he was going to do more work on it when he got home, and he's going to send out a notice. So, it was crazy.
Yeah.
It's like I got in there early because he told me about it. It was like probably 5 or 6 hours later when everybody showed up.
Yeah.
And I knew, okay, Wong's newsletter hit.
Yeah.
and every seat was taken, and it was just a casino that had $100 maximum.
Wow.
It was a little joint. I think they had like 6 blackjack tables,
$100
sure. maximum. Every table was packed.
Yeah.
Every single one. I think they had to call in their other dealers that got so crowded. And then people were just standing behind the tables waiting for someone to get up and use the restroom so you could jump in and bet on their spot. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And they had to they had to call it off that night.
Yeah. Oh, sure.
It's like, because everybody was winning.
Yeah,
everybody
sure,
was winning.
Right.
And, and there was another one. There was a promotion, a Lucky 13 promotion at the Morongo Casino.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to that one, and that one they called it off before it started.
Yeah.
The tables were absolutely packed. Everybody had, and now Morongo had higher limits.
Right.
I can't remember if they were $500
or
$1,000 or something, but everybody had purchased maximum maximum value chips.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like the promotion was supposed to start at 6 p.m., And like around 5:30 p.m., they said, "Well, we're not going to have the promotion tonight." Oh man, it was like
you have a story in the book about our mutual friend Max Rubin helping you figure out a promotion at some Northern California Indian casinos.
He fronted the money for it.
Okay.
Yeah. The California casinos, a lot of the things that Wong posted was coming from these California casinos, and. They had these were Native American casinos,
right.
And they had some kind of a weird law where the game of 21 was against the law.
Right.
And so there's a lot of these casinos, they had a version of 21 that they used with 22 instead of 21. And then some of them had other weird, they somehow got away with using 21,
mm-hmm.
but they were doing other 2-for-1 on blackjacks.
Right.
And they would run these. What the law was, the law also forbade them from profiting from the gambling on these tables.
Mm-hmm.
I never really went in to read the law.
Right.
All I know is that they would have these crazy promotions. And, and I found a couple of them. I was living in California, and there were a couple of them. There were Native American casinos all over the state.
Sure, yeah.
And I found a couple of them that I had not seen him report on, and they had weird promotions.
Yeah. that you could just look at it and know it was beatable.
Well, yes. I knew it was beatable, but I didn't know how much. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what would be the best strategy.
Right.
In other words, and I didn't have computer software to try to run off simulations.
Mm-hmm.
And I contacted a guy who had written software. He had written some really great software for analyzing blackjack.
Mm-hmm.
And I called him and told him about this, and he said, yeah, you could do it. And like a couple days later, he sent me the complete strategy, yeah. the value, mm-hmm. the, you know. And I did this for a couple of them. One of them turned out to be really valuable, meaning that, like, you know, I could make money on it.
Right.
And so I played. What I did was I called Max. Mm-hmm. Now, see, I'm still working full time at the post office.
How long did you do that?
Let's see. Blackjack Formula came out in 1980.
Yeah.
I didn't quit the post office till 1993.
No kidding. That long?
Yeah, I went 13 years publishing that newsletter. And by that point, I was making so much more on the publishing company than I was from working right. at the post office. And the post office was taking more time.
Yeah.
It was a full-time job.
Yeah.
And so I had to let one of them go.
Sure.
So obviously I let the post office go. But at this point, I was still working at the post office, and I called Max and said, I explained the rule to him and the analysis. I said, nobody knows about this. I said, you know, it wasn't Stanford Wong, and I said, you know, I'll probably publish it in Blackjack Forum, and maybe somebody will do something with it. But I said, I asked this guy to analyze it. He analyzed it for me. I don't feel right publishing his analysis, mm-hmm. but he sent it to me. I sort of feel like I can go out and play it.
Yeah.
But, you know, I said to place the max bet, and the max bet wasn't even that high. It might have been 100 or mm-hmm. 200 or something like that. I said, I don't have the money to just take the fluctuation
right.
on that.
Sure.
He said, well, how much do you need? And I was a few thousand. I think it might have been 5,000
yeah.
or something like that. He said, yeah, okay, I'll give you the money. You go play it, and we'll split 50-50.
Yeah.
And I said, great, okay. And I did. And I went, it was like, I think it was a once a week thing, every
yeah.
Tuesday night or every mm-hmm. Wednesday night or something. And there were no people going in there specifically to play this.
Right.
It's like, again, because Stanford Wong hadn't announced it,
right.
none
yeah.
of his people had
right.
alerted him to it. You know, it was just like the locals that normally played in there. They went, oh, on Tuesday nights they do this. And I cannot remember exactly what
yeah.
it was even. In fact, I corresponded, while I was writing this book, I corresponded with the guy who had done the computer work on it. He couldn't remember.
Yeah.
He said, oh, man, I lost all that stuff. That's from 25 years
yeah.
ago. And I said, oh, yeah, geez, you know.
That's crazy. So why did you discontinue publishing Blackjack Forum, and when did you stop doing that?
I stopped doing that. I think it was the last issues were like the winter of 2002-2003.
Okay.
First of all, I had quit my own publishing company.
Okay.
Basically, I sold the mm-hmm. RGE Publishing.
Okay.
But I kept Blackjack Forum.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't go with the publishing
right.
company. And also the rights to all my own books. But
right.
basically all the other books, I mm-hmm. basically said, you know, look, you know, you got to pay them their royalties now.
Right.
Here's the contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want, you know, second editions, or you got to work it out with the authors
right.
yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm done. I'm done. I'm tired. I was just tired of publishing.
Sure, right.
You know, it's
yeah.
like, it was
a lot
of work.
Job. Just like the post office. Right?
It was a lot of work.
yeah.
And I took Blackjack Forum, and I went to Anthony Curtis at Huntington Press and said, look, this is the only thing I kept. Why don't you be the publisher?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, look, I'm tired of it.
Yeah.
I'm tired of the layout, the
mm-hmm.
design, the advertising,
right.
the flyers, the subscription renewal. I'm done with it.
Yeah.
I said, I don't have RGE
mm-hmm.
publishing anymore. I don't have a publishing business. He said, yeah, okay, I'll pick that up. I'd, you know, be happy to,
sure.
to publish that. And he did for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
Up until, I think it was probably in 2001 or so, where I got rid of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of 2002,
okay.
I decided to not even publish Blackjack
right.
Forum
okay.
anymore. It was just a lot of work.
Right.
And to me, it was more work than I needed to do
sure.
for
right.
whatever money it brought
yep.
in.
So what do you think of the blackjack scene today? Obviously, it's really degenerated with the 6-5 blackjack and all these crazy rules. I don't think that anybody stands on soft 17 anymore. You know, I mean, it's just become a really bad scene for bettors.
The games are, it's not the way it was,
right.
That's for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, back in the 70s, 80s, 90s, the games were, that's when the games were best.
Right.
You know, I mean, again, even in the early 80s, you know, it was legal to use computers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like one of the, probably the second most common way, the most common way for anybody to beat blackjack is card counting.
Right.
And that's because there's been 400 books written about
sure,
how
right.
to do it. A lot of the card counting games are not very good anymore.
Right.
My understanding is, again, from talking to players, is that the better games are not in Las Vegas.
Right.
They're not
yeah.
in
mm-hmm.
Atlantic City.
Right.
You know, you go out into the Midwest, go into the Native American casinos
mm-hmm.
and the riverboat casinos
right.
and the dockside casinos and, you know.
Even some of the little card rooms up in Washington
right,
State,
that,
you know.
Yeah, that they still do have
yeah.
some fairly decent games.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're not going to take, you know, $10,000 bets.
Right.
But they're, you know, they're pretty well,
mm-hmm.
you know, financed operations.
Right.
That, you know, they can handle the bets of just about most players.
Right.
But the game itself is just, it has definitely deteriorated,
mm-hmm.
Primarily because the casinos got tired of trying to deal with card counters.
Yeah, sure, right.
And hole card players.
Yeah.
Like a whole lot of their procedures
mm-hmm.
now are to so that you can't see hole cards.
Right.
There's no way to get the hole card.
A lot
you
of
know?
Times they don't even deal the hole card till,
or they don't even deal it. Right.
Yeah.
In other words, they basically came up with all these, and you know, and then the thing of just making the game, you know, it used to be so close.
Right.
You know, it used to be that like a single deck game was even off the top.
Right. Yeah.
You know, if it was a shoe game, that was a 0.5% for
mm-hmm.
the house. You know, they made their money in that game because people didn't know how to play. They didn't know basic
right.
strategy. So they, you know, they would get 2, 3, 4, 5% from people just because
sure.
mistakes.
So are there ways to get an edge at today's casinos? I mean, do they do the math for all these promotions correctly? I mean, I've seen certainly when it comes to somebody like Don Johnson, he comes in with a proposal and they accept it. It seems like they don't do the math.
Yeah, the Don Johnson situation, similar to Phil Ivey with the
right,
background.
Right, sure, yep, yep.
In where he...
he figured out how to get an edge and
right. There, in other words, there are always going to be ways to beat the games.
Right.
Don Johnson was using multiple techniques.
Right.
And plus, getting the casino to agree to a lot of, you know... player favorable
exactly.
situations.
Like, what do you call a session? Is it an hour or is it a day? You know. When,
right. Yeah. He would.
That was one of the.
You know. Well, he was asking them for, I think, for 50,000 front money.
Right. Yeah.
Meaning that he'd come in, he'd put his however millions into the
mm-hmm.
cage, they'd add 50,000 to
right.
it, or they'd give him 50,000 extra chips.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah. I mean, things like that are just crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's sort of like they. They don't seem to understand a lot of the casinos. It's crazy for businesses this size.
Mm-hmm.
They seem to not have real competent math people.
Right.
Like I'm sure they have CPAs. They get their
of course, right.
they get their taxes right.
Well, you'd think these guys who had been in the business all these years would know the math, you know, or have somewhere to go with the math, but apparently they don't.
Well, I think
some of them do. I mean, there were a bunch of casinos that rejected any Don Johnson's deals, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure, and
yeah.
I'm sure, you know, Phil Ivey may have proposed
sure.
the same type of thing, and I proposed things to casinos
yeah.
that they
mm-hmm.
didn't go for.
Right.
But I used to ask them for better rules and you know. Will you take the automatic shuffler off the table? I
right.
want the dealer to
yeah.
shuffle the cards,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Right.
And basically, when you have a lot of money, they stop and think, and they say, well, we'll talk to the casino manager, right. And they talk to him, and he go, well, who is this guy? And he said, well, he wants to come in with a couple $100,000, right. And but he doesn't like the machines, you know, or he wants us to stand on soft 17 instead of hit soft. Does it make a difference?
He said, yeah.
Well, very slight. Sure, we'll do it. Yeah, if he'll put the in other words, they're not stopping to figure out exactly.
Right.
They're assuming you're not a card counter.
Right.
And like, if you do enough crazy things, you don't look like a card counter.
Sure. Right.
Because basically, when I was playing, we were tracking shuffles. Mm-hmm. And then also we were exploiting the loss rebates,
right.
And they didn't understand either of those things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the like shuffle tracking is way. You know, I would find it difficult myself to watch a game in progress and tell you that a player was or was not tracking a shuffle.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like you can't tell by his wins and losses. Mm-hmm. It is extremely difficult.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, it's so.
So how about online casinos? They're offering lots of bonuses, and actually the rules on blackjack are fairly decent on the online casinos. Of course, I think you don't know, you know, whether they're using just random number generators or how they're actually stacking the deck against you.
Yeah. Now we did online play. Now, mm-hmm. You know, the 2006, the UIGEA,
right.
Federal law against online gambling, and basically what it was a law that forbade the banks from doing transactions,
right.
With online casinos.
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't make it against the law for players to play,
right.
But you had no way to get your money in and out,
right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
there was a banking system called NetTeller,
right.
There really was just a bank.
Sure.
It was a big,
right.
Bank.
Yep.
But they were the online bank.
Mm-hmm.
That did all the money in and out of all the online casinos.
Right.
And the federal government shut them down. You know, they said,
sure.
No, because you're doing these illegal transactions. You know, they made this law immediately now.
Right.
Nobody's allowed to do this. Hey, you, yeah. You did a transaction.
Right.
You're under arrest.
That law is still in effect, which is, you know, complicates,
right.
A lot of the illegal casinos transactions even.
Right. Like, well, see, like, what we were doing was we were exploiting their marketing programs.
Right.
You know, their marketing programs, they had all kinds of cash back for this,
sure.
And
right.
Loss,
yeah.
Rebates for that, and you know, get you know, we'll double your win if you do this, and you know, just all these crazy things. And professional gamblers just started figuring them out, and
right.
They went, this is crazy.
Yeah.
You know, we can make a lot of money.
Sure.
At this, we don't know how much money, you know, we don't know if we trust them,
right.
You know, but there were ones you could trust and,
yeah.
Ones you couldn't.
Yeah.
But anybody could play at just about any level.
Yeah.
And what it came down to was the software companies. There were a certain number of software companies. One was Microgaming.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few others that they were trustable.
Yeah.
Because what they did was they created software for the games. You know, and they'd have blackjack games, and they probably had craps, roulette, you know. But they created the software, and the casinos that wanted to offer the game had to lease, like some kind,
right,
of a lease,
sure.
Or rental, yeah. Agreement with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't actually get the software on their own server.
Right.
It stayed with Microgaming.
Right.
And so they were trustable.
Mm-hmm.
Because they were essentially, if you found one of these software companies that was legitimate, you know, they would have their software in dozens of casinos,
right?
And so you'd know, okay, this one I can trust because it's Microgaming.
Right.
They stand behind their software as being honest. You know. But there were a lot of casinos that created their own software, you know, their own proprietary software.
Right.
Those were the ones that you couldn't trust.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the East Coast, like I think in New Jersey now, right. they have casino.
Sure.
They yes. have casino online casino.
Legal online casinos, right?
We don't have that in Nevada.
Not yet.
We have poker.
Right.
Poker. Well, poker is completely different.
Right.
Poker, you're playing against other players.
Right.
The house just takes their little rake out, you know. Yeah. And in fact, a lot of poker players like the online games because it's a smaller rake.
Sure.
They don't
yeah.
take the yep. same percentage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of, you know, say other difficulties with online poker.
Right.
If you're good at reading players,
sure.
and
right.
you can't see anybody. It's
exactly
just, you know,
right.
there's no one to see. There's
yeah.
no, you know.
But there's also a lot of inexperienced poker players who come
there's,
online and
there are
and
yeah.
think they can beat anybody and they're the fish.
Right. But like what happened was when UIGEA came in 2006, we had a huge business going
yeah.
with
mm-hmm.
online casinos. We
right.
had play, you know, we had multiple websites. Well, one of them was the Blackjack Forum online website,
mm-hmm.
which was just our Blackjack website.
Right.
But we had all kinds of information on that site on how to beat these online casino promotions,
right.
you know, how to basically, you know, milk them for mm-hmm. the bonuses.
Right.
And, but all of those casinos were interested in putting banners on our site,
right.
which made us an affiliate of the casino.
Right. Right.
And so we got a percentage of the losses of all the players who played
mm-hmm.
on our site.
Right.
And, you know, we had like a lot of pro players that were specifically playing through our site because it was like we got to split the loss rebate. You know,
right.
basically what
yeah.
we were getting was sort of like a mm-hmm. loss rebate,
right, sure.
you know. So they were getting, they had sort of a loss rebate deal with these casinos. And we were just basically, we didn't even have to play.
Right.
We just
yeah.
put the banners up. And
that's the beauty of the affiliate system.
Right. It was, you know, it was working great. Oh, when UIGEA came out, we couldn't believe it.
Right.
We were like,
yeah.
this is horrible. You know, this is the easiest money we ever made
right,
gambling.
Right.
And now we can't do it anymore.
Right. So tell us about what you're doing now. You have this site called Topless Vegas, which is the adult entertainment in Las Vegas. You rate it. You give information about it. How does that work?
Okay. Well, technically, this site came about during that online gambling period.
Okay.
We had set up multiple sites
mm-hmm.
so that we could put up these casino banners.
Right.
Well, okay. So I got this brilliant idea. We were living in Vegas then. And I got this brilliant idea of, hey, why don't we put up, you know, that we'll put up a website that reviews all the strip clubs and the adult shows, the
right.
topless
yeah.
shows and the casinos, you know, the
right.
just the adult entertainment,
sure.
legal adult entertainment in Las Vegas. Because,
yeah.
you know, that's people are coming here for
yeah,
that.
Right.
Okay, so what I did was I ran around from to every strip club and I wrote down the cover charge and how much a beer costs
right.
and what the price of a lap dance was, and if they had VIP room, just all the different
right.
things, you know. And I wrote reviews, and I wrote it as if I was, I took this persona, Eddie Montana, and he was like a grubby biker dude
yeah.
that just you know, sort of, you know, would tool into from one parking lot to the other in a strip club and go in and check out the scene, and, you know, and he was the reporter. And we set this site up, and one of the things is, like, when we would set up a site, we would have to get traffic, you know, like
right,
we would
sure.
set up a slot site, you know,
yep.
we had slot secrets, you know, and because this is when we were milking slots.
Right.
And, you know, we got the casinos to advertise there, but in order to, you know, you have to have some traffic.
Sure.
And so now I have no idea how this works now because, again, this was 16,
mm-hmm.
17 years ago, whatever.
Right.
But you used to be able to buy traffic.
Yeah.
Not even expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like, I don't know, you'd get like, you know, 1,000 hits for 10 bucks
yeah,
or something,
right.
1,000 hits a week for 10. So we said, well, let's just start buying some traffic so
yeah.
they can see we got some activity on the site, you know. But really what got them to put their banners up was that I was writing articles, you
mm-hmm.
know, I would review slot machines,
right.
you know, and it was all crazy. A lot of it was just, you know, fun,
sure.
you know, But we had what was content. Like the people that had difficulty, you know, a lot of people got the idea of, oh, geez, this affiliate pay sounds right. like a great deal. But they had no traffic, mm-hmm. and they had no content,
right?
You know, which is one of the reasons they had no traffic.
Right.
Whereas, you know, whereas like we were buying traffic for these slot sites until the slot people started putting their banners up, and we started actually then generating right. really real traffic. Well, with the topless site, we didn't have to generate any traffic.
Right.
We put that up and it was like, hey, there's a website that reviews all the strip clubs in Las Vegas. Yeah. We got traffic. It's like, hey, we got traffic. We couldn't find a single online casino that would put a banner on that site. And they would all just send back an email that said, we don't do anything with X-rated material, you know, we're a family casino or something, you know.
That's funny because the affiliate marketing in Europe got started as being porn affiliates early on, and then they transmitted to online casinos, so that's really funny.
Yeah.
So what's next for Arnold Snyder?
Oh, I don't know. I think I'm just taking a break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know.
I've been writing crazy books,
yeah.
but whether or not I'll ever get any of them published, I sort of feel like, you know, I ought to get my little superior printing press
right.
out.
There you go.
Yeah.
Start cranking it out again, right. So this is your book, Radical Blackjack. You can find it at Huntington Press. I'm sure Amazon has it as well. Congratulations on writing this book. It's very, very informative and entertaining. I hope people really start to pick it up. And Arnold, thanks for joining us, and our viewers, thanks for joining us today on the podcast. Hope you enjoyed this week's podcast, with thanks again to Konami Gaming. Visit KonamiGaming.com/premium for more on the year's best slot product, Dimension 49J. To learn more about how professional gamblers can threaten casinos, visit GGBMagazine.com. To get all the news of the gaming industry delivered to your desktop every Monday morning, visit ggbnews.com and enter the code GGB180 for a free subscription. Don't miss a single episode of the podcast. Sign up on Spotify or Apple Podcasts today. So we'll see you next time on the GGB Podcast.